Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by SuperValu Insurance, looking out for you and yours with our new life and mortgage protection insurance.
Well, you might have read about Davina McCall over the past few days and how she has just undergone brain surgery for a colloid cyst, a benign cyst that was discovered in her brain. Well, Irish independent journalist Melanie Finn is the entertainment correspondent for the newspaper. She lives in Dublin and she has a busy home life along with her busy job. She and her husband Owen have three young boys. In July of last year, Melanie's world was turned upside down when she got similar news to Davina McCall, news that nobody wants to hear. She tells her story in today's Sunday Independence Life magazine, and she's here with me today. Melanie Finn, good morning to you.
Hi Miriam, thanks for having me.
Wow, what a story. Listen, let's go back to the summer of 2023 and remind people what your daily life was like. Work, three boys, summer camps, busy, busy, busy.
It's like any other parent, you know, you're so busy. The juggle is a struggle. You're running around, you're doing a million things, you're multitasking. You know, there's 10, 15 plates spinning in the air any given day. So I've been with the Irish Independent for nearly 20 years and my husband has a very busy job as well. And we've three small boys. So with that setup comes a whole lot of demands and responsibilities and there is really no one else to do it. And I was so caught up in the busyness of everything, of our life, I suppose. It wasn't until there was a very serious situation that I realised how sick I was.
So when did you kind of notice feeling yourself a bit off? I mean, what were the symptoms?
They were very subtle and they were intermittent, which was why it was so kind of sly, I feel. Because like that, I've been kind of tired. I had a bit of memory loss, occasional double vision and headaches. But they could be any number of things. You know, you're running around and like I say, they came and they went. And then at the start of February 2023, I remember it because RTÉ were launching the Eurosong. So I was on my way to Montrose and I was doing the school run with the boys and I collapsed or I thought I tripped. Is what I thought happened near where we live. And I came to, I was in the middle of the road and my two sons were on the road beside me looking down. And they said, Mammy, what happened? And I said, oh, I must have tripped. You know, I'm horrifically clumsy at the best of times. And I just kept on what I was doing. You know, there was no one else to take my young kids to school. So just kept on walking. But it was only afterwards I realised I was really dizzy and I was kind of, I felt like I was going to get sick. And so I rang the GP and I rang work and I got myself checked out and everything came back fine. And so I just carried on as normal, as you do. And then at the end of June 2023, we were taking a little trip, me and the boys. So I pulled them out a day early from school and I was packing the car and I suddenly found myself lying face down on the gravel driveway of our home and no recollection of what actually happened. And again, my poor kids, they were like, Mammy, what's wrong? And I said, oh, I must have tripped again. Silly me, I am so clumsy. And I rang my mom, Mary, and she was like, there's something weird here. You know, you need to get yourself checked out. And I said, Mom, I've got plans. You know, there's no one else going to do the stuff that you do on a daily basis. So carried on. About a week later, I was in the middle of covering what was the RTÉ crisis at the time.
Yeah.
And it was a Thursday afternoon. I was working from home and I went out to get a cup of tea in the kitchen. And I remember kind of stumbling. I was so dizzy. I felt like I was going to fall. And I remember grabbing the kitchen counter and I got this feeling, Miriam, and it's really hard to describe. It was like this kind of, it was this feeling that there was something just wrong. Something was amiss, but I couldn't tell you what it was. I wasn't in any pain, which is normally, you know, an indicator when something's wrong. And suddenly I remember this journalist friend of mine telling me how she had carried this referral letter around. She had concerns about one of her breasts. And when she eventually got there, you know, it was confirmed that unfortunately it was cancer. She's totally fine now, thank God, touch wood. But I don't know why it came to me. It was like this really weird gut feeling, you know, like that survival instinct that we all have. So I rang the doctor and I made an appointment, another one. And so rocked in the next day in my gym gear, no sense of anything was amiss. And it was a locum on and she said, I think you should go to the matter private, you have healthcare. And I remember being a bit, oh, Jesus, like you're making a massive deal about this. You know, do I have to head in? I've loads to be. Yeah. And I rang my husband. He wasn't on the road, thankfully. He could come home, take the kids. Rang my sister because I was quite dizzy at this stage. She drove me into the matter private and it was busy. It was a Friday and it was kind of mobbed. So I explained the situation to, I guess, the triage nurse, and she said, we can't see you, don't have an appointment or a referral from a neurosurgeon. Why don't you try the matter public? Because at least they can do a CT scan there. And I said, that's fine. So we went outside and again, I really didn't want to go in. I was busy, as I said in the piece in the Sunday Independent. So my sister was like, I think she could see more from the outside that something was amiss. She's like, no, I think we should keep going. We'll go in and see. And I said, okay, but if it's busy, I'm not staying. Like, I don't want to be in an ED, you know, horrible scenes and all the rest. So we went in and they did a raft of tests. They were amazing. But they also made me do a CT scan, which I thought was weird. So eventually, I'd say it was about 4 hours later, a consultant called me in and he said, we know what's wrong. And we know why you've been having these unexplained falls. They're not falls, they're losses of consciousness, blackouts in layman's terms. And what's wrong is you have something in your brain and it's full of fluid and it's getting bigger and you'll need emergency surgery maybe tonight. And I remember him being kind of triumphant because he said to me, it's a good thing that we found this because we normally see them in postmortems. Wow. So I did what any normal person would do. Like I burst into tears. And so I went out to the waiting room. Miriam, it's really hard when you're trying to explain complex medical information about your brain, when your brain is the thing itself that's unwell. Mm. So I took that information he gave me. I went out to my sister. I regurgitated it. I think he mentioned a colloid cyst, but they wouldn't be sure until they did the operation. I'd never heard of that. I didn't even know you could get cysts in your brain. And then I had to ring my husband and that was really hard. So I said the same thing I'd said to him, to her, to my sister. And he said, you're joking. I must have a terrible sense of humour. I was like, I'm not joking. You know, this is happening and we need to get a plan, you know, I need a bag. I had nothing with me. I had a chicken fillet roll, a water bottle, and I was in my gym gear. So, yeah, quite the land.
But when he said that to you, Melanie, that they would have to do almost emergency brain surgery, what was going through your head at that moment?
It was very hard to process. I think I was in shock. I'm pretty sure I was now looking back. I mean, the first thing I thought of, you know, was this can't be happening. This is the stuff that happens to other people. And I wasn't in any pain. So, you know, pain is normally the indicator that something's wrong in your body. So I went into a state of denial and a state of shock, but also a state of absolute panic and fear, like the most I've ever felt. And then I had to wait for, you know, at this stage, I had been admitted to the matter, but they had to wait for someone who was free to bring me to Beaumont. And I remember saying, can my husband not drive me? Like I hadn't processed it. And they were like, no, you need a nurse to go with you at all times. They're waiting for you in Beaumont Hospital. So it was nighttime by the time I got there. And I remember gazing around the ward. It was a high dependency unit and going, oh, and I'm in the wrong place. I said, these people are really sick. They're all hooked up to machines, you know, various states of consciousness, unconsciousness. And he said, Mel, I think you're really sick, you know. And then that was kind of the start of realization that there was something seriously amiss.
And when you got to Beaumont, Explain again. It's something called a colloid cyst. Is that correct?
Let me think about putting this in layman's terms. You can get cysts anywhere in your body, apparently. And a lot of times they're totally benign and they don't cause any interference whatsoever. So the thing I had, a colloid cyst, it's called colloid because it's the substance in it is colloid fluid. And it was right in the centre of my brain. So it's somewhere near the third ventricle, it's called. And it's right where your brain makes the cerebral spinal fluid that goes around your brain the whole time. It bathes the neurons, it keeps it healthy. What was happening in my case was it had grown and grown and grown to such an extent that it was stopping the movement of the fluid around my brain. And that was why I was having these blackouts, and that's why I was having these symptoms. So by the time I had got to Beaumont, I had obstructive hydrocephalus is what it was called. So your brain normally looks like a cauliflower. Mine at that stage was smooth because it was filled with fluid. So then there was a bit of a waiting game for the surgery.
And what did they explain to you they were going to do? What was the treatment and who was going to do it?
So I was under the amazing Professor Dunica O'Brien. He's got one of the leading neurosurgeons in the country. I was very lucky to have him, and he was so reassuring. He answered my many, many questions. I went into journalistic mode when I first saw him. And, you know, between myself and my husband, Owen, who was a former journalist, you know, there were so many things. You know, you're doing your research in a place where you're not well and it's your brain that's malfunctioning. So he explained it that, first of all, they were going to do another scan, this time an MRI, which is more detailed imaging of your brain. And they were going to map out the surgery. They needed time to plan how to do it. And they were going to put a small little camera on like the teeniest of instruments. When they got to the cyst, hopefully it's called defenestration. It's basically obliterated enough so it wouldn't be a problem anymore. And you're talking about something, I think from my discharge notes, it was about 3 millimetres. So not even the size of a pea, but it's where it was that was so serious. So although it was benign, it was life threatening. That was the issue there. So it was mapping out the surgery, locating it, and then interfering with it to such a degree that it wouldn't cause any more problems to me. So to do that, they had to access the brain, and the whole procedure is called a craniotomy. And when I first heard about it, I said, hang on here. I said, like, I like my brain. It's high functioning. It serves me well. I'll have to think about this, particularly when I heard where the cyst was beside the speech and language and short-term memory function. So obviously they're pretty key aspects to when you have a job like mine as a journalist. And one of them very gently explained to me, this isn't optional. You know, we can't discharge you. If we do, you could drop dead in front of your 3 children at any time. And Miriam, that sounds really harsh, but actually it was what I needed to hear at the time. Mm. And I think in those circumstances, you know, you're terrified about handing over control, aren't you?
Mm, yeah.
You know, and it's about putting your faith in science and medicine, and also having that idea that it wasn't my time to go. Like that the events that led me to being in Beaumont in the first place were indicators to me that it wasn't my time, that it had been caught for a reason, that it simply, you know, it wasn't my time.
So before you went on to the operation, how did you feel?
Terrified. Absolutely terrified. So they explain it to you in, you know, bald terms, your part of your head is shaved. Then they basically saw, you know, your skull. They take a piece of the bone flap out of your skull and then start at the procedure. So it would be from, you know, 4 to 5 hours. It's so probably one of the most complex, if not the most complex, surgeries anyone can perform. And complete awe of Professor O'Brien and his team, how they can even do this. And I believe it's not something that they could even do until a few decades ago, you know, and the rate, survival rate of brain surgery, you know, a century ago was about 50%. You know, so thankfully the odds and the technology has improved so much more in the meantime. But I have to say, I've never been more terrified in my entire life. And you can do all the meditative thoughts you want and your yoga breaths. Sometimes you just have to admit you're absolutely petrified and sit in your feelings and feel your heart racing like it's going to come out of your mouth practically with the terror. And I remember one student nurse sitting with me, and it was about, I think it was about 6 a.m. and it's a really quiet place, the Richmond ward. You know, it's for people with severe neurological conditions, so no one's like bantering, so to speak. She just sat and she just held my hand. She was called Emma, and she said, you know, you're here because you're a fighter. You knew something was wrong, you felt it was wrong, and you got it checked out, and that's why you're here, and you're going to get better. And sometimes that's all you need to hear, you know. And I just think the public health service gets such a battering sometimes, you know, and you hear so many sad and unfortunate stories. I'm sure I've covered them myself, but in this instance, I just, you know, I was in complete awe of the medical staff there in such a busy acute hospital like Beaumont. Like, the things they do is nothing short of miraculous. You know, right from the porters right up to someone like Professor O'Brien, you know, a neurosurgeon. And I just felt, even though I was terrified, it was in the right place and everything was going to be fine. Even if I didn't know that was the case, I was going to tell myself that was the case. That was going to be my mind message. I was going to be fine. I was going to survive. And I was going to go home to my three boys and my husband.
What did you say to Owen and the boys? Could you talk to them before you went under?
No. I was too unwell to leave the ward at that stage. So I'd went in on the Friday and the surgery was Wednesday morning. So there's no under 16s allowed in the ward for very good reason. People are there very, very sick. So they don't let kids on the ward. I asked to go down and meet them in the canteen, and they said that wasn't possible. I mean, I couldn't even. My family came in the night before, and my lovely in-laws from Loughrea came up. And I remember I went to get up, but I was dizzy. So it's such a short trip down the corridor, and there's a little family room, and I couldn't make it. I was in a wheelchair.
When you woke up from the operation, can you remember that moment? Can you remember what you thought?
When I woke up from the surgery, I remember thinking I was going to feel this kind of Hollywood style wave of relief, you know, like a euphoria, like, oh, I did it. I survived brain surgery. Aren't I great? It's all over. And I didn't. I felt so overwhelmed. I felt like I was a stranger in my own brain. It's the only way I can describe it. I felt like I'd been run over by a bus. But the first face I saw was my lovely husband's. And I recognized him, and he was there, and I was like, okay, I'm through that. I recognize him. And as far as I can tell, things are more or less, you know, the same. That's what I felt. But it was a far longer road to recovery than I thought it would be. I suppose, yeah, that's what I'd like to say is also, like, people might think now, like, oh, sure, she bounced back, or look at her now. Wasn't that, you know, an easy road? It was like, this is what, like 16 months after all that, it was horrendously long. And I suppose in terms of the recovery, like brain surgery is very nuanced, and you do the most recovery in the first 6 months. And then after that, it's so tiny. The gains are so small. And also, if you had a broken leg and you had a cast, people would instantly know, oh, you're recovering, you're not well. Mm-hmm. Whereas this was all invisible. So people maybe wouldn't understand, like, why I was hesitating, or why I looked confused, or why was I so tired, or, you know, why wasn't I functioning like I had before? And it's because it's all invisible. So the tiredness levels was just off the charts. There was days and days where I could barely get out of bed, you know, and everyone just rallied, family, friends, the community, classmates, parents. They just were so supportive, and they made sure, like, the boys never missed a party or an activity or a soccer training or a GAA match. They were so lovely. And my husband like, he deserves a sainthood, Miriam, for putting up with me. Like, as I said in today's piece in the Sindo, like, I'm a very impatient patient, you know. And as I said in the piece, I'm not the same person I was before the surgery. And that's fine. That's good, because I'm still alive. I'm still here to tell this tale. And as it's all been invisible and not perceptible, you know, to other people, I suppose a bit of me was reluctant to even write the story in the first place. The easier thing would have been just to carry on and pretend it hadn't happened. But where would the lessons have been learned from doing that? I mean, I've spent my life telling other people's stories, and that's been a privilege and an honour. And this is just another story. It happens to be my story. And, you know, if anyone listening takes one thing from this, it's like, if you feel like something is amiss or something's wrong, like, get it checked out. Go to your GP. Don't wait. We're all so caught up in the busyness and the minutiae of our lives, you know, that you do often miss the kind of small stuff. And I just, for example, like social media, I came off it for a year. It made me feel crap. I was like, everyone's having an amazing life. I'm sitting here in my pajamas, like, binging on Netflix because I feel so rotten. And I still really haven't, you know, gone back on it. I'll put my stories up on X and that's about it. And I try not to sweat the small stuff, but I think it's human nature to still sweat the small stuff. I also had a lot of people, you know, during the year of recovering say to me, God, you were very lucky, weren't you? And they don't mean it in any, you know, ill-intentioned manner. They mean it in a really nice way. And I didn't feel lucky. I still don't feel lucky. I don't think anyone who's had their life upended and gone through a really painful, difficult year of recovery feels lucky. I do feel fortunate. I feel fortunate it was caught, and I feel fortunate that everything played out the way it did on that fateful Friday when I went and got myself checked out. And it's like those sliding doors and, you know, moments in your life. You go down one avenue, one thing happens, and you go down another route and this thing happens. And then this thing happened for me. And I feel like it's a really hopeful story. It's about listening to your inner gut, you know, that thing that we don't listen to anymore because of modern day technology. We're all so, so busy, you know. And yeah, just listening to that inner voice that goes, hang on a minute, you better mind yourself because you don't get another chance. No one is guaranteed a tomorrow.
As we come to the end as well, you said a little earlier that you're not the same person. First of all, what do you mean by that? But secondly, is your life more enriched, or is that a foolish thing to say? In other words, do you appreciate life even more than you did before?
I do, of course. Yeah, I do. I do feel like I'm in a much better place. I mean, I'm back at work. If you told me a year ago that I'd be in the space, that I'd even be sitting here talking to you about this, I would have said, I go on, there's no way. And I have to say, like, the Irish Independent work have been amazing. I am on a graduated return. And I do feel, I remember, you know, one particular therapist saying to me, you're not going to believe this now, but stroke patients, for example, say sometimes it's the best thing that ever happened to them because it gives them a chance to put the pause button on their lives and rejig it and reset it in a way that makes them feel happier. And I didn't believe it at the time. I said, oh my God, this is the worst thing that ever happened to me. Like, I'm flattened. And I do now. You know, the body's ability to recover is amazing. Mm-hmm. And we take it for granted so much, and we take life for granted. But sure, you only get one shot. Give it your best shot, you know, because it's amazing. And I eventually took this holiday we'd been meaning to take to France for a year. So it was booked in August 2023. We took it in August 2024, a full year later. And I was standing on the beach with Owen and the three boys. It was our first day and we're in the sea. And I just felt, Jesus, life is good.
Oh. Melanie Finn, it's an amazing story. People should buy today's Sunday Independent and read it. It's just very powerful. I've known you a long time and I just want to say I'm so pleased it worked out so well for you in the end, Melanie. And thank you for chatting to me today, and stay well.
Thank you.
Lovely reaction to Melanie Finn's interview. I have time for one. Maria Burke in West Cork says, what an articulate and wonderful account of the experience for Melanie. I'm a public health nurse, and at times it's our presence and time and listening that matters, like what that student nurse offered to Melanie. Great that she's doing so well. More reaction coming in on Melanie. I'll bring you one more. Miriam, Melanie Finn is so honest and brave in telling her story. She's described her journey in such amazing detail and with such emotion, which took a lot of courage. No doubt she has helped lots of women this morning. That's from Orla in Cork.